Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another Science Studio program. Keith Pannell, Russ Chianelli, and today we've got a guest from Canada, Deborah Van Nineten, and she's at the Wilfrid Laurier University, nicely named after the first Prime Minister of Canada. Unfortunately, they located it in a place called Waterloo, just to the west of Toronto. So, Deborah, thank you very much for being here.
A pleasure. Thank you.
Well, Deborah, I know that you're a professor of political science and North American studies at your university.
Yeah.
But you've got a particular interest in cross-border issues. That is, you know, if you've got a big issue, is it the same on both sides of the border?
Mm-hmm.
And it clearly should be, except that different governments, different agencies, that's why you're in political science. So
yeah.
It's going to be interesting. And I know also one of your issues is water and climate.
Mm-hmm.
So there's enough to get about two programs of Science Studio.
Yeah, indeed.
So where would you like to start? What's important about knowing, let's say, the political infrastructure on both sides of a border in order to deal with a common problem?
Well, you know, I'll start by telling you the story of how I got going in terms of transboundary environmental cooperation, right? So why did I get interested? My first job as an academic was at the University of Windsor, which, of course, is within spitting distance of Detroit. And
I think it's the other way around.
Yeah.
You spit from Detroit and the winds from the west.
Well,
the other way,
actually,
it's tough.
Actually, that's exactly right, because I got an apartment right on the Detroit River there. And, of course, I could see the whole Detroit skyline. And I had this little balcony, and I bought these lovely my first new set of patio furniture, right? So I put it out on the balcony. A few days later, went out. It's covered in what I thought was soot. And I thought, what's going on here? What's landing all over my chairs? Of course, I said to my colleagues, what's going on here? You know, and it smelled funny, too. And I wasn't quite used to that. Certainly, southwestern Ontario gets a lot of pollution from the U.S. Midwest, the way the prevailing winds go, but I'd never seen it quite so, you know, tangible. I could smell it and taste it and see it and, you know, and I kept wiping it off every day. And my colleague said to me, well, that's pollution from Detroit. And I thought, well, for heaven's sakes, can't we get a handle on this? You know, this has been, they told me, happening for decades. And I'd known about it, but not really, you know, didn't really understand it was going on. And so I started doing research on it. Well, why? What's coming over? What kind of air pollutants and what kind of agreements are there in place? And, you know, how are we cooperating to solve what is an obvious problem? And in the course of my research, I realized that there were heightened respiratory illnesses in Ontario, but also, of course, in the U.S. Midwest. And that started it.
At the beginning of your journey.
That was the beginning of it. And at that time, coincidentally, Canada and the U.S. were negotiating a new accord to add on to previously existing Canada-U.S. Air Quality Treaty.
So, but in the end, of course, your response to this was to move further inland, go to Windsor, just get away from the border.
Yeah, well, sort of. I mean, in Canada, almost everyone is within about, you know, 50 kilometers of the border, 100 kilometers of the border, right? So where I live, I can drive to three Great Lakes within, you know, 60 to 90 minutes. So the U.S. is very clear and present for all Canadians. And so are the pollution issues.
Okay. So is it pollution you want to talk about now, or water quality, or weather, climate? What? We've got 28 minutes.
Yeah.
The floor is yours.
Okay.
You just pick on something and we'll ask questions.
Okay. Well, there's so much to talk about, because I have to say that now, after 20 years of watching how Canada and the U.S. cooperate in terms of environmental issues, it's a very good relationship. They've done a lot together. So I did air quality. I also looked at cooperation on climate change issues. So, you know, joint scientific endeavors, looking at how to reduce emissions of some greenhouse gases and things. That you know, there's not a lot happening on climate change, but, you know, some innovative discussions and, you know, things that were going on. Water quality is the real interesting issue.
Okay, so
So why don't we?
Live right next to the Great Lakes. What is it?
Right on the Great Lakes.
22% of all of the drinkable water in the world.
Absolutely,
is
at my doorstep, and my family and I spend a lot of time around the Great Lakes. And
does
so
that
does
mean
everybody.
We own 11? We Canada owns 11% of
doesn't
the world.
Doesn't work that way.
It doesn't work that
no.
way.
No,
tell us.
No, and indeed, if you look at the way the Canada-U.S. border goes through the Great Lakes. Like it just, it goes, it bifurcates four of them. It's just so beautiful and then goes out to the Atlantic Ocean. So we have to cooperate, right?
Right.
But the cooperation there, I think, is a real success story. There was a treaty, the 1909 Boundary Waters Treaty, which looks similar to the treaties that apportion water on this U.S.-Mexico border. And that treaty was intended at the time to resolve conflicts over water, right? And to deal with water levels, because water levels on the Great Lakes do go up and down, depending on the kind of weather and climate we have in any given year.
You said 1907?
1909, yeah.
1909.
So it's been around for a long time. So the water levels go up and down depending on how much snowpack we get. And, you know, it's the same kind of thing and runoff, whatever's going on. And it was very successful in dealing with conflicts. So there's a good process under the treaty. But what was really interesting is that there was one clause that essentially says, thou shalt not pollute the waters to the detriment of thy neighbor, pretty much, right?
Okay.
And that little clause became the foothold for an entire infrastructure to deal with pollution in the Great Lakes. So not just allocating water, which we don't really allocate it, but there are some conflicts about waterways and things like that. A lot of navigation issues because we have a huge amount of trade with ships going through the Great Lakes. But here was a means of dealing with air water quality issues. And there are some very serious water quality issues in the Great Lakes.
And that's a more modern feature. I mean,
yeah.
Right at the beginning, there
was sanitation.
Okay, yeah. that was the pollution was that.
Yeah,
got you.
Yes,
and now it's industrial at every level.
Exactly, industrial, but also invasive species. So species from Eurasia, from the Black Sea, from all other places
coming
that are
over on the hulls of the boats.
Ships.
Right.
Exactly. Although Canada and the U.S. really the U.S. led that as well. They've solved that. So there's a set of regulations for ships coming into the Great Lakes in terms of how they deal with their, the water in their hulls. I forget what it's called again.
Ballast.
Ballast. Thank you. So that has been really addressed.
I thought you were going to tell me that the ships had to wipe their bottoms before they were allowed into polite society.
Actually, they make them do them out at sea.
So give us an example of some of those species that weren't there.
Zebra mussels. Are you familiar with zebra mussels here?
Yes, I know what a zebra
mussel
is.
Zebra mussels are horrible. So those mussels get into the water. They propagate really easily. And what they do is they like to colonize water intakes and outpipes. And so they clog them.
What do you mean by that?
So they literally fill the pipe so that the stuff can't get out. Right?
Like, what is it that about that small space that they like? Is it where fresh water or dirty water is?
I really don't know. It might be warmth. I really don't know. But they colonize everything, and of course they're on
and they're not
boats
edible.
And infrastructure, and you can't. No, they are still there, and they're everywhere.
No,
right?
But can you eat them?
No.
Are they edible?
No, I don't know anybody who eats them.
Really.
Could you?
I love mussels. I mean, and
I
so a zebra
the
mussel.
The way these look, I don't think you'd want to eat these ones. Yeah, and they cost hundreds of millions of dollars a year for Canada and the U.S. to cope with the colonization of zebra mussels on the water infrastructure. And
so that's around on the coast.
Yes,
that's the coast.
Indeed.
In the middle, you won't see this.
Yeah,
right.
That's right.
Okay,
but you know there are plants that come from Asia that the wind just brings over. Okay, there's nothing we can do about that.
Yeah, no, it's true. Some of these things are brought to North America in different ways, and it is very difficult to cope with them, particularly once they're here. So, for example, here on this border, you have real issues with invasive plants.
By this border, you mean now Mexico, USA?
And the Rio Grande that clogged the Rio Grande as well. So it's
yeah, but some really of those plants, which I've worked on, it's called the salt cedar, which comes from Africa. It's clean metals out of the water.
Yeah. Well, the zebra mussels, it's interesting because they actually, one of their functions is that they clean the water as well. The problem with that is that the sun penetrates more deeply and stimulates the growth of weeds at the bottom, and that then uses up the oxygen. So then the native plants or the native fish have a hard time living in that environment. So it's changed the aquatic habitat for native fish species. So some of the native fish species are really struggling. We also, way back in the 40s, realized we had a problem with sea lamprey, which was like, it looks like an eel. Literally, it's like a vampire. It you know, clamps onto fish and then, you know...
sucks their blood away.
Yeah, well, yeah. And they get diseased and then fall off as well. So, and they propagate, they reproduce
You're getting down
quickly.
And dirty as a political scientist, I'll tell you.
Well, you know, when you do environmental policy, you better learn some of the science, otherwise you can't understand what you're talking about.
That's what we're doing on that. Science Studio.
Yes. Yeah. So tell us then, where do you see the success of the Canadian authority and the U.S. authority in what they're trying to deal with now in terms of these zebra mussels? What's the joint work that's going on?
Microplastics, and we have problem with algal blooms, right?
Oh, yes.
Too much fertilizers and runoff, same as on this border. So the infrastructure that has grown up on the border to facilitate cooperation is really quite something. So I talked to you about the 1909 Boundary Waters Treaty, but we also had, beginning in 1972, an executive agreement called the Great Lakes Water Quality Agreement. And it has actually been updated regularly over the years. The most recent iteration is 2012. Okay, that's the most recent one. And it is less a set of regulations than it is a set of processes for people to get together in different forums to talk about problems and shared solutions. So there is something called the Great Lakes Executive Committee that meets twice a year, and those are officials from agencies in both countries. They get together and set priorities, assess what has been done in the previous,
Do they have spending authority?
Well,
I mean, it's one thing to have people sit around like a faculty committee meeting,
with no funds.
No funds. Yeah. And if you even have funds, no enforcement. So how is that particular feature?
It's an excellent question. People bring money to the table. So it's literally a contributory thing. And Canada and the U.S. have always done that. So on air quality, one of the best stories I heard was that the Americans would actually lend a plane to the Canadians, and it was one of those planes that was specially outfitted to take, air quality modeling measurements or data. I don't know much about that, but so they would jointly do this, where you've got the plane and I've got the computer, and bring it together and work on it together, right? They do that in the Great Lakes. All right, so what have you got for science or for modeling or we can contribute this, we can contribute that. Who's got this data? Who's got that data? Let's all bring it together.
You're listening to Science Studio, Keith Pannell, Russ Kinelli, Deborah Van Nineten from the Wilfrid Laurier University in Waterloo, Ontario.
Welcome
Canada.
Back,
Keith
we'll be
Pannell,
back
Russ Kinelli, and Deborah Van. And she's, it's easier to say Van than go through Van Nineten from the Wilfrid Laurier University. Okay, so you were telling us that there's a setup for sort of meetings to discuss, and then but people are bringing things to the table.
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely.
And that means that they've got authority from where? Like in on say Superior, is this authority from the provincial government, Ohio and the Michigan and the various states, or is this fed to fed?
Well, the umbrella relationship is fed to fed, right? But the state and provincial agencies are very involved, right? So what you had, for example, under the Obama administration was a very large amount of money that was set aside called the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative. And what it did was funneled resources to those agencies, both EPA and other federal agencies, but also state agencies that were working on these Great Lakes cleanup issues. Okay? So it was appropriated specifically for that purpose and led to a lot of work. Now, right now, the Canadians have put more money forward. Honestly, there's an ebb and flow, right, politically. And that's where the politics comes in. Some administrations in Canada or the U.S. place a higher priority on the Great Lakes, and so they're more supportive. Others are perhaps less supportive. And it's not that one side is more supportive than the other. It's both of them kind of ebb and flow. Almost always, though, there's at least one government that's pushing, right? And so the other one has to kind of, you know, come to the table.
I would have thought that the provinces in Canada and the states would be much more proactive than perhaps the federal governments, because it's right on their doorstep. Mm-hmm. Their people are utilizing the Great Lakes, for example, both for commercial uses and recreational.
Well, yes and no. Again, it depends politically. So we had a government in Ontario, you know, Canada's largest province population-wise, right?
But you also have a problem up there in terms of the east part is French and the west part is English.
So, yes, Quebec. So that's one, a little less than one quarter of the population speak French. But at the governmental level, almost everybody's bilingual. So
bilingual?
Yes. Yeah. So in Ontario, a lot of the folks would be able to speak French. Certainly federally, everybody does.
Pretty smooth. From what you're saying also, by and large, the relationship between the two organizations on both sides looking after the Great Lakes have got a pretty good commonality.
Oh, yeah. And anyone from Quebec who's at Great Lakes meetings, all the Quebecers speak English. It's not an issue. Yeah.
So then what are the big issues then? Let's just transfer from the lakes to this business of climate change without putting any sort of particular labels onto why we've got it at the moment. But what are the big issues that you see there, trans-border?
Well, I think the biggest issue is whether governments are supportive of doing anything about it. And right now, our Canadian federal government is moving ahead with a climate change action plan. It's called the Pan-Canadian Framework for Climate Change. And it has a number of elements. Some is supporting new technologies and renewable energy and, you know, low emission things, and then moving on regulations in some areas. So lower emission cars, dealing with coal burning power plants, stuff like that. Okay.
The other Detroit is a big issue within the United States.
Oh, yes. Yeah, that's right. Detroit and Ohio. Yeah, mm-hmm. That area there. And we have in place now a carbon tax.
Ah, you
nationally.
Do.
Yes.
So we have a carbon tax in British Columbia. We have had since 2008.
Well, tell the listener what that translates into. What does that mean?
So that means that any entity that burns fossil fuels, right? And of course, you have to treat the burning of, you know, differently depending on the purpose. But you would assess them a tax per ton of carbon emissions, right? So in British Columbia, that covers pretty much the whole economy, right? There's some industries like
cement. Well, I know the carbon tax is something that's argued about, too, because there's a connection with loss of jobs.
So in British Columbia, they have not found that to be the case. So it's 10 years now, 11 years now in place. Yeah, 11 years now in place, and the economy has grown every year.
But let me just make it clear to myself that what you're saying is that any industry, any product, let's say this styrofoam cup here, mm-hmm. there's a certain amount of the use of of carbon.
Yes.
To make it, it is made out of
yes.
carbon polymers.
Yep.
So there'd be an extra tax on the cup based upon the content of carbon?
So it's usually for the process of making it.
All
yeah.
right.
Now, the other way you can do it is you just put a fuel surcharge on, right? So you can tax fuels.
Right.
And then anybody who buys the fuels or uses the fuels, right? That's what Quebec does. So Quebec has had a carbon tax for a long time, too. And so it is essentially a fuel tax.
You mean when you go to the gas station, there's the usual tax, and then there's another one added on, which will be called the provincial fuel tax.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's a federal tax. Quebec, yes. So Quebec, it would be an additional tax.
But if you go south of the border to Mexico or to Venezuela, that doesn't happen. And huge amount of gas burned down there and so on, gasoline.
Yep. Oh, yeah.
So there's a difference between Canada, U.S., and U.S. and Latin American companies. Countries.
And the other complication here is that most of our oil and gas is refined in the U.S. We don't have a lot of refinery capacity as well. It's very complicated.
Right. I mean, there's several things here. I just want to get to a point, that if you want to think about this carbon tax, when people say, we should all have solar panels, and I have completely solar panels all over my house, but there's got to be a carbon content to that, too, in the process.
Yep.
So that would also
be
included.
And other chemicals.
Right.
Chemicals. You know, yeah.
But, I mean, so everything that's gone through a process in British Columbia, so they have a whole team of people working out how on earth you make this stuff, right?
So
and then
no,
going
actually,
backwards?
I'll tell you what. When you have a carbon tax, it's pretty straightforward. You run it just like any tax. So it's just like a sales tax.
Oh, so it doesn't really impact really the carbon content and the carbon footprint of a product. They simply said that would be too complex, and so we're going to put on an X percent.
Yes, it's a formula.
Oh,
yes.
Okay. All right.
But there will be some differences across industries. Okay, so that's a carbon tax. I think it's not that it's easy to implement, but it's relatively straightforward. It's the emissions trading regimes that are more complicated. So British Columbia and Quebec have carbon taxes. The European Union has an emissions trading regime. California has an emissions trading regime.
Then you have the pipelines.
Just go back before he brought that in. But so you've got this, what was it called?
It's an emissions trading regime.
Okay.
So that's where you literally allocate permits to pollute carbon or to emit carbon, and those permits cost. So per ton of carbon, right, how much does it cost to pollute it? So the overall regime would say, here's our cap. Here's how much carbon we're going to allow the economy to emit. All right. Then we're going to issue permits to these different industries and entities. After you do that, then you say, you know, here's where we need to be at the end of the year or at the end of 5 years or whatever your target is. That cap's going to go down. And then the incentive is to lower your emissions so you can sell your extra credits on the open market and make money.
And is that working? I mean, it sounds very clever because it's, you know, you run a company and you say, hey, look, we can make money because they've given us this certain amount of volume or this amount to pollute,
mm-hmm.
but we're going to make our process so efficient that we don't need that.
And
that's
then we're
going to
sell
income.
Them and it's going to be a source of income.
And that's working well
so
in
Canada?
So
that's the idea. Ontario joined into the emissions trading system with California. Quebec had already joined. So Quebec has that fuel tax, but it was also joined or had also joined an emissions trading system with California where you can sell and buy the credits.
So you can get a credit in Ontario and use it
sell it in
California.
Absolutely.
Okay, I didn't know that. That is a big international collaboration.
Yes,
right.
Yes, and it took many years, and you know they're still kind of working it out.
So this is where, in fact, the provinces and the states
are leading,
are doing much better than the federal governments.
Yeah. So now you can see where I'm going with this, though, because if we have a national carbon tax, then we have some provinces that have carbon taxes, some provinces that are involved in emissions trading regimes. They operate differently. How do you put them all together to achieve a national goal? How do you set it up so that you even know that you're meeting the goals, right? So the federal cap goes down, and the provinces have to show that they're achieving a certain price per ton of carbon. When you're doing emissions trading, that's hard. That's hard to show.
But it shows that at least both sides of that border were cooperating in one sense, even if it's not fed to fed.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for example, Canada is still in the Paris Agreement, I suppose.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
And so that's going to create tensions which will unwind into the future.
Mm-hmm.
Look, I can see British Columbia's got this tax. Is it a separate pot of money that goes to a particular goal?
Okay, great question.
Or does it just get thrown in?
Okay, so here's where the politics come in. So I'm going to get all political science-y on you. So remember I said Quebec had joined the emissions trading with California, and so had Ontario. The government in Ontario changed last summer to a conservative government who said, we're out of here. So they pulled out of the emissions trading regime, even though companies had invested literally billions of dollars in buying up these permits to emit. And that created some chaos, okay? Then the federal government said, look, every province, this is a federal system, so provinces might want to take their own approaches, said Prime Minister Trudeau and the Environment Minister McKenna. That's fine. You do what you want within your jurisdictions, as long as you meet our target of price per carbon. So you can do a carbon tax, you can do emissions trading, but if you don't have anything in place, the feds are going to tax directly in your province. However, all of the monies collected within the provincial jurisdiction go back to the province. So even if the federal government collects that tax,
they give it back.
It goes directly back to the province to spend as it will. But as a punishment for those provinces that first signed on to this pan-Canadian framework and then pulled back because they governments changed and conserved, the federal government said, no problem. We're going to give a rebate check directly back to our voters in that province. So we're not going to give the money to the province. We're going to send rebate checks to individual people. So whatever they paid for that carbon tax, they get a rebate.
Deborah Van Nineten from the Wilfrid Laurier University in Waterloo, Ontario, Canada. Thank you very much for being here. And it's different to talk about science and scientific aspects, but from a political point of view, we don't do that very often. At least not formally. We do it in the bar a lot. But anyway, that's the end of the program. That's what I'm trying to say here. So thank you for listening, and we will be back next week with another Science Studio.